Gulfport, Mississippi. The Gulfport Code is the first new code to be adopted following Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast. While it is an optional code added to the city's existing regulations, it has immense potential to serve as a model for other communities as they rebuild. It is apparent that the development of the code brought the community together under difficult circumstances, with many additions to the base smart code, a tactic intended to embed the code in local practice. Gulfport.
Thank you, Liz. I'm going to, in 1 minute, try to tell you what got us here, and it's a quick journey, and I'll try to do it in 60 seconds. My name's Brent War. I'm the mayor of Gulfport. 2 years ago, don't count that applause time against my minute, okay? 2 years ago this month, I was elected mayor of Gulfport, and on my first day in office, I declared a state of emergency because there was a tropical storm out in the Gulf of Mexico. Friday of the following week, we did it again because Hurricane Dennis was out in the Gulf of Mexico. The following Monday, a developer came in with a terrible project, and I didn't know exactly how to handle it. I had never experienced any municipal government before, but it was a big, about 145-foot-tall glass football to be down on our beachfront overlooking the Gulf of Mexico. And I said, well, this is terrible. It doesn't look very good. And they said, well, what about it do you not like? I said, I don't know. But it looks awful, and I don't know what to do. And they said, well, there's nothing you can do about it because it fits within the boundaries of the zoning. And all we have to do now is go get a height variance. And I thought about it. I said, well, I think I'll appoint the people that give those. And we don't have a quorum, so it's going to be a while before they can meet. Five weeks later, Hurricane Katrina came through and a 26-foot wave and 210-mile-an-hour wind. So that from the man from Port St. Lucie, when you commit to change, sometimes you have to be a little bit careful about what you commit to because sometimes you get more than you want. But after that storm, Andres Duani and a team of about 210 of the most incredible people came in and explained to me and the rest of South Mississippi what it was that we had been doing wrong for so long. And from my humble opinion, Gulfport got the best team. They're here with us. And fortunately for us, we're the largest city on the coast, second largest in the state. We're still small by many standards, about 80,000 people. We had the best team, and there have been a lot of people give a lot of time. So I'd like to just say, as the representative of 80,000 people, in South Mississippi who went through the worst natural disaster in American history. We thank you for coming up with this. We thank you for your dedication and your care and your prayers. And we're gonna really, really, really be great. Give us another few months and come see us. Thank you very much.
Few more months. The last award goes to Farmers Branch, Texas. The expected 2010 development of a new rail station on the Dallas suburb of Farmers Branch served as the impetus for this code. It's a model for new development at a project or sites at a site-specific scale, with excellent graphics and minimum verbiage contributing to its clarity. One interesting aspect of the code is its applicability to two different downtown plans, the street plan as it currently exists and an alternate, a plan with additional streets and plazas to make the station area even more pedestrian-friendly. In addition to building placement regulations, the code also provides architectural standards. Farmers Branch, Texas.
I'd like to thank the Institute. My name is Andy Gillies. I'm the planning director for Farmers Branch. Timing was mentioned several times tonight. I think in this project especially, timing is everything. We have a new rail line coming through Farmers Branch, and the farm and the form-based code is going to work wonders for our community. We had a great team worked on this particular project. I'd like to thank Jeffrey Farrell, if he's in the audience. I haven't seen him earlier today. Mary Madden also worked on this project. I'd like to thank them. They were, and the previous planning director for Farmers Branch was Kaiser Rangwala. He's now with the, and he did wondrous work, and I am here to hopefully take the implementation of the form-based code to a new level. And thank you very much for this award. And if there are any developers in the audience that want to do a transit-oriented development project, please see me after the meeting. Thank you.
That concludes the awards. I should say, I think one comment is appropriate, that giving these awards out in their first year on the opening night of the Congress, even though it's delayed our speaker a little bit, is truly an important thing to do, because any of you that have been involved with code writing know that it really requires that famous religious trio of faith, hope, and charity. Because you don't see the results of what you're working on. And the work is very hopeful about a better future. It's a bit dry, and you're not exactly sure always what the results are of what it is that you're writing, how people will interpret it. And so you need to be, as well, exceedingly kind to the people you're working with, because there's always a terrific amount of stress in writing regulations over land that has varying value, and sometimes the stakes are very high. So I think everybody knows what I'm talking about. But to recognize the kinds of efforts that are done behind the scenes of what is often glamorously otherwise exposed, the actual built projects, is really a great advance, and we should be thanking the people who began this institute, the Form-Based Code Institute, and also their supporters who made this awards program possible. So thank you very much. So on to the final event of the evening. It gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce our speaker, Witold Rybczynski. The mere thought of being with Witold makes me smile. Perhaps it is our shared Polish heritage, or both our appreciation of Philadelphia and its surroundings, that gives comfort at the mere prospect of his presence. Or maybe it is his skeptical approach to new enthusiasms, which somehow seems familiar. For sure, one always looks forward to hearing Witold speak, for the certainty of learning something new while being entertained. Witold tells you more about things you think you know than you ever thought there was to know. Reading Rybczynski is to marvel at the creative process of selecting a subject, researching, and presenting it. He provides a framework for knowledge which makes any topic seem rational and pragmatic, even as he sweeps across history, social observation, and political nuance. He revels in searching for and explaining the reasons for something being the way it is, on subjects ranging widely from the story of the screw to the story of real estate development. I'm sure he would deny any implied connection between those two. Witold is the Martin and Margie Meyerson Professor of Urbanism at the University of Pennsylvania School of Design and Professor of Real Estate at the Wharton School of Business. This dual assignment alone proves that he likes a challenge. Born in Edinburgh, Scotland, of Polish parents, and raised in England and Canada, Rybczynski completed his professional architecture studies at McGill University. While he devotes most of his time to teaching, research, and writing, He has maintained his involvement as a registered architect with active design and building throughout his career. An accumulation of publications as architecture critic for online magazine Slate, as essayist for The Atlantic, The New Yorker, New York Times, and others, and as author of numerous books, you know them, Home, The Most Beautiful House in the World, City Life, and others, show the depth and breadth of his engagement. He has been described, and I quote, as one of the most original, accessible, and stimulating writers on architecture. And another quote, one of the clearest, most sophisticated minds writing today about how the design of cities, with observations at once about the design of cities, with observations at once current and timeless, accessible and elegant, equally appealing to laymen and professionals, free of jargon or knotted ideology. Many awards recognize his achievements, including literary prizes, honorary doctorates, and his post on the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts. In the past year alone, he has received three major honors: the 2007 Seaside Prize, the National Building Museum Vincent Scully Prize, and from the American Institute of Architects, the Institute Collaborative Honors Award. This is truly the year of Witold Rybczynski. Witold's latest book, Last Harvest, How a Cornfield Became New Daleville, should have been required reading for this Congress meeting. If you are lucky enough to have read it already, you will have an enriched experience of this conference and this city. The title Last Harvest refers to the quote, unquote, new crop of vinyl that has been the ultimate destiny of historic farmland in states like Pennsylvania. Indeed, Philadelphia's growth and economic sustenance has since its founding been tied to the development of its surrounding countryside. If you drive out Old York Road, for instance, you might remark on the linear extension of colonial-era houses, the predecessor of the sprawl new urbanists abhor. Witold weaves the history of land development in the region into the story of a new community, with surprising details about our founding fathers that tie present-day efforts to their legacy of colonization. Additionally, the story includes new urbanism's early trajectory, as well as some debunking of our popular notions of suburban sprawl. So following on Mr. Hanna's advice, I would also advise you to go out and buy the book while you're here in Philadelphia. But given its topic and what he'll be speaking about this evening, it is appropriate indeed then to have as the opening speaker of the 15th Congress our gentle critic, a man who ceaselessly encourages us to learn more about what we do, Witold Rybczynski.
Thank you, Liz. I too would like to welcome you to the city. And I'm very pleased to be here. And as you'll hear, new urbanism is something that I've been observing and thinking about and writing about for quite a long time. And I'm glad Peter Katz mentioned the New York Times, because that's where I'm going to start. In 1989, which is almost 18 years ago, I was asked to write an article for the New York Times, and I can't remember anymore if they suggested the topic or if I did, but they wanted me to write about the city and about architecture in the city, and the piece was called Architects Must Listen to the Melody, and my thesis was that buildings in cities should observe a kind of music together, and that there were actually rules about how this could happen. Let me just read you one short paragraph from the beginning. One of the greatest architectural shortcomings of most of our modern cities is the apparent inability of builders to produce large numbers of unassuming but satisfying buildings that can form the backdrop for the occasional important landmark. Instead, what we have are cities composed increasingly of aspiring landmarks, which is to say, cities without any landmarks at all. I've tried to make the point in the article that there were lots of precedents for the idea of building with rules. And I gave a number of examples, Georgian architecture in Dublin and London, or Edinburgh's New Town, closer to home, Boston's Back Bay, which was an urban development. And all of these examples, all of these developments had rules about how you would build these new houses. They were all large sections of urbanism built all at once. And I thought, I was pretty pleased with myself. I thought it was an interesting article. But I got a phone call back from the editor. This was before email. We still spoke to each other. And he said, you've given a lot of examples, but they're all kind of historical. Isn't there something a little more contemporary you could add to your list? Because after all, readers will be interested in this, and you should find something contemporary that could illustrate your point. And I thought, I agreed with him, but I thought about it, and I couldn't really think of anything that really illustrated that. I didn't know of any recent developments. And then I remembered I'd read an article about this little town called Seaside. And so I wrote about it. I hadn't seen it, but I had seen photographs. Anyway, I was desperate. I didn't have anything else. Plus, I did want to get into the New York Times. It was the first time they'd called me up. So I wrote about it as best I could, not having seen it, and the article was published. Later that year, I actually did get a chance to visit it, and I wrote about it again, I think much more intimately, having experienced it. And that was in, as I said, in 1989. Seaside was only very partly built, but there was several streets on the, the west side of town or the north side of town? I don't remember the orientation. But I distinctly remember walking around the town at night. Like most architects my age, I was raised, taught architecture around the issue of housing. For my generation, housing was architecture and architecture was housing. And the problem, the challenge of architecture was how to build housing for large numbers of people in a way that created a satisfactory environment. And I'd visited many projects both in the United States and Europe, Canada, and I had to admit that I never actually saw housing that quite fit the bill. There were sort of interesting buildings, but there was always something raw and unpleasant about the environments. And they were never as nice as the older cities that I saw on those trips. There was always something unsatisfying because, of course, they were designed by one person or perhaps a group of architects, but with a like-minded idea of what they were doing. And what struck me so much, as it did many people who visited Seaside, was walking around at night, you actually were in one of those little old towns that you liked, and you had to remind yourself that this was all new, that this wasn't a cornfield, I guess it was a swamp or something, but it was something created rather quickly. This was probably about 6 years, 7 years after it had started. And it somehow had achieved this quality which so many architects wanted to achieve, but really hadn't to that point. It had somehow eluded us. And I think at least part of that had to do with the rules, and we heard about that earlier. And part of it had to do with this idea of that there was a way to create the vernacular environment that we all liked that in a more sort of systematic way. Since then, I've seen other projects, both by Liz and Andres and other architects. I took part in a charrette, so I sort of saw the process from the inside, which was very educational. I have a I have a slide, I think nobody else has this, of the first homeowner at Celebration unloading his U-Haul. He was literally the first person there. That's part of development that's always really interested me, because we live in a country where that first homeowner phenomenon keeps reoccurring. I mean, you can imagine the first people in Philadelphia when the city was laid out in grids. They were all sort of over there near the river, but they started sort of filling it in. But somebody had to be the first one, and that's something that's very interesting about what I'll talk to you in a little while about this project that I followed, because that act of being the first person in the cornfield is repeated over and over again in these various projects as the country grows, as more people build. My latest book, which I've spent about 5 years writing, is called Last Harvest, and it has a very long subtitle. It's called How a Cornfield Became New Daleville, Real Estate Development in the United States from George Washington to the Builders of the 21st Century, comma, and Why We Live in Houses Anyway. And if you run out and buy this book and read it, you will have answers to all those questions. But I thought it would be interesting, because of your interests and because of the people here, to talk about what I learned from this experience. Because what I did was, you saw some slides here of suburban developments, and they're always aerial views taken from a plane, very high up, and the houses are tiny. And of course it looks scary. Anything taken from high up looks scary, because all you see is objects, you don't see people. And many books on the suburbs or on suburban development or planning use those photographs on their jackets. And I didn't want to write that kind of book. I wanted to get much closer, so that the houses were not simply little objects like a Monopoly game, but to see the people who were thinking of those houses, who were planning them, who were living in them, who were building them. In other words, to see the human process that produces this. I believe that we use words like sprawl precisely to dehumanize the process, because sprawl, after all, sounds like some kind of new disease, and it's often described that way, not as a human process, not as a place where ultimately families live, children grow up, and so on. So I wanted to get closer, and I wasn't sure how to do that. And it struck me that perhaps one way was to tell it as a story, to follow a project through, not an original idea. Tracy Kidder had done that for building a house. And I had actually written a book myself about building my own house. So I knew that a story was always more fun to read than simply statistics. But I thought, if I do this as a history, I'd written a biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, and I knew that when you're writing history, of course, you know the end of the story. And so you're asking questions because you know that Olmsted will become a famous architect one day and build Central Park and all these beautiful places, and you're sort of trying to understand, how did he ever get there? But real estate development, which I didn't know a lot about, but I knew enough about it to know that it's very unpredictable, that it's not so neat. And I thought it would be better to take an actual project and sort of report on it rather than write a history of a project. If one wrote a history of Seaside, for instance, it would be this terrific success story at the end, and it would be hard to capture the downside of Seaside, the moments when everybody was despairing about selling houses, when it seemed like a really dopey idea that everybody, the experts, all knew was a dopey idea, and that why would people want to live this close together? It's hard to capture that in hindsight. I thought it would be better to do this in real time, to follow a project where I didn't know exactly what would happen, and where, you know, all the optimism at the beginning would also have its ups and downs. And that's what I did. My friend Joe Duckworth of Arcadia agreed to allow me to do this. And I did something very dangerous, I realized, when the book was published. The hero of my book is a developer. Oh, thank you. Actually, there are two developers. There's Joe Duckworth, who is the seasoned, dare I say, slightly jaded, enormously experienced developer who teaches me a lot in the book about development. And there's also his son, Jason, who is the idealistic new urbanist developer who's learning about development. And I wish I had thought of this, but a reader pointed this out after the book was published, that we learn about development because Jason learns about development from his father. And so the story is Jason learning about development and coming in from a non-development background and sort of getting immersed in this and discovering the ups and downs and the ins and outs of this chosen profession. I was also very lucky because Tom Comita, who was mentioned that many of you know, was actually the consultant to the township on this project. In other words, he was not on the side of the developer. He was advising the township about what they ought to be doing. I also met a young architect who sat on the planning commission, whose family has lived in this part of the country. This is all taking place in Chester County, Pennsylvania, which is sort of an hour and a half west of here. His family has lived there for seven generations, and so he's rather rooted in that place and very concerned about what's happening. Like most people, he hates development and developers. But he's on the planning commission, and he's trying to deal with all this. And there are many characters, because what surprised me about doing this was that it really ends up a story not so much about ideas as about people. The architect from Lunierick's Kiss, who advises the builders about how to make their houses look better. The lawyer who writes the code for the home ownership association. And then finally, at the very end of the story, the family that's buying one of these houses. Why are they there? What do they see? What do they want? How do they decide? They're very early buyers, so they can put the house wherever they want, they can choose which lot to buy, they can choose, and they have to go through this whole process. So the story really takes you from the sort of big issues of the national builder and how they operate and development, right down in the end to this, the point of all of this, the point of all you people here, which is a family wants a home to raise their children in and have a life in for a certain number of years, and that's what they're looking for. So I thought it would be interesting to kind of, as I said, for this audience to hear sort of what did I learn from this process. You can read the book, and the book is also about development. There's a lot of historical material about Levittown and the various early development projects, as well as Seaside and Celebration and Vince Graham's projects in Charleston. But I thought it would be interesting to talk about sort of what did I learn from getting immersed in this project for 5 years and talking to all these people and observing what was going on and sort of reporting on it. I should say that one of my first books, or certainly my first successful book, Home, I included a quote from Milan Kundera in the foreword, which was, let me make sure I get it right. To be a writer does not mean to preach a truth, but to discover a truth. That's always how I've approached writing. So here, too, I was writing about a new urban project because that's the sort of project it was. And I was interested in that anyway because I knew a lot, I think, about the early history of new urbanism and many of the people involved. And I was sympathetic, in any case, to the goals of new urbanism and this kind of development. But I was really more interested to discover the truth of what was going on rather than to convince the reader of any particular point of view or opinion. So I'm more speaking to you now more as a reporter, I think, than a polemicist. One of the things that surprised me, and it kind of shocked me, it was right at the beginning of the project, one of the team showed me the pro forma for the project, which is the projected costs of the various bits and pieces that come together, the land, the consultants, the whole process. And one of the smallest expenditures of the developer, because of course the developer is the one who's funding all this, was the planner. The planner at that point was, I think, budgeted for $10,000 or $15,000. It ended up being more than that because the project was a little more complicated than anybody thought. But it was a very small amount compared to all sorts of other expenditures. And like you, I'm trained as an architect, I practice as an architect, and design is how I approach the subject. And yet it appears that design is actually pretty small potatoes in this process. The developer necessarily in my story is the center of the story because he's the person who gets it going. He's the person who makes the ultimate decisions. He raises the money. I also learned developers don't actually have any money. They are always using other people's money. I think it's because if you have a lot of money, you don't go into anything as risky as development. You go into something much safer. So planning, despite the fact that many town planners here and architects, and despite the fact that all of you, I suspect, approach new urbanism from the point of view of the planner, you should know that's a very skewed perspective. It gives you, I think, you miss many of parts of the picture that way. The other thing I discovered, is, as I mentioned this, is that development takes a long time, particularly in the Northeast, California, any place where people really don't want development. It's not a coincidence that the four prize winners, whom I congratulate, that we just heard, are all from the South and the West, because those are the few places where people don't hate developers. They like progress. They're still optimistic about change. They're not huddled, as we are in the Northeast or California. So this process is a long process, and selling TND only complicates it, so it certainly doesn't speed it up. I don't think it necessarily slows it down, because I think it's very slow anyway, but even in this story of mine where the municipality was actually open and they encouraged new urbanism because they were interested in trying something new, even so, with a number of supervisors who were sort of pushing everybody along, it was a very slow process. People have a lot of questions and concerns about it. I devoted a chapter which probably isn't of interest to the general public, but I hope would interest people here, to the whole issue of styles. Because there was a lot of discussion in this project. At the beginning, the project was going to be a very local project. It was going to use the styles of Chester County, and it was going to get away from the generic, anonymous kind of suburban building that was seen all over the place. I don't think it achieved all its goals in that regard, but I think the reason it didn't is that there are all sorts of difficulties. It's hard to figure out actually what the style is in Chester County. My own feeling is that there are places in this country where you can find architectural styles, which the community sort of agrees are our style, in the Lowcountry of South Carolina, for instance. But those places are actually rare. Most of this country isn't as clearly identifiable by style. First time I went to Cape Cod, I realized that even the Cape Cod cottage really doesn't belong to Cape Cod anymore. It's something that you find all over the country. And plus, in Cape Cod, there's a lot of other things than Cape Cod cottages. There are Victorian houses and there are modern houses. So I think it's an interesting debate. It's one that should keep you debating, because I think it's a complicated question. I also surprised myself by coming to the conclusion that generic traditional was actually not a bad thing, because I interviewed the architect from Lunéric's Kiss, Mike DiGeronimo, who talked about, I said, well, what kind of style do you think you're going to do here in New Daleville? And he said, well, I think it'll be generic traditional. And I didn't say anything, but I kind of cringed and I thought, what a cop-out. And then I thought about it, and I thought, he's right, that if we go around the United States, there are some beautiful revival-style buildings, but most buildings are kind of generic. I live in a 100-year-old house, which is stone, but which I can't really characterize the style architecturally. It's got a pitched roof, it's got dormers. It's generic. It has little porches where you enter. It has multi-paned windows, but it doesn't have any particular authenticity architecturally. And yet it's very recognizable to most Americans would recognize it. And I think that's what developers in this country have built, you know, for a couple of centuries. And it's probably, for many builders, kind of mostly all they could manage. Getting the styles right is very difficult. You know, getting authentic details requires a lot of knowledge. It's also very expensive. And so, you know, shooting for generic traditional may not be a bad goal. Seaside, like many of the early projects of the new urbanism, was built by custom builders, one house at a time. Seaside even had architects. I mean, they were young and underpaid, but nevertheless, they were very well educated, mostly came from Yale. So the houses are beautiful, but that's really not the way we build housing in this country. We don't build it with custom builders. We don't build it one at a time. And unfortunately, probably, we don't build it with architects. So one of the interesting things about New Daleville is that the builders was a national builder who builds about 15,000 houses a year, who has an architectural office somewhere in Virginia, who has six factories up and down the East Coast, and very efficiently and at really quite good quality provides housing at a really kind of ridiculously low price compared to what a custom builder can achieve, probably about a third the price. So we have to find ways, or I should say you, since I, despite what Liz said, I no longer practice, although I did for a number of years, you have to find ways to translate the rather wonderful architecture of Seaside into something that national builders can actually grapple with, because they can't grapple with Seaside. Seaside is not the model in terms of how you produce the houses. Something else has to be. Vince Graham has found another model in Ion, and I write about that in the book, and I have enormous respect for him, but I'm not sure that too many people could pull that off. I'm not sure if it's really the right model for most developers. The national builders, I mean, there are pros and cons. They can build at $40 a square foot. If something goes wrong, you call them up, they come and fix it because it's only one house and their reputation, which they've spent years building up, is more important to them than spending a little bit of money fixing your squeaking door. So they keep the customers very happy. We know from surveys that people are satisfied with the buildings they produce. On the other hand, they do produce one type of house. They have probably 10 houses that they produce for small, narrow lots. So there are some options, but you know, they're all built with the same window, which is how they get to the $40 a square foot. There's a price to be paid for that, and the challenge is to find ingenious ways to sort of leverage that into some kind of variety. And I should say that New Daleville, in terms of quality, is really quite good. The architectural quality, considering that it is built for $40 a square foot, I think is a real achievement. I hung out with the salespeople. I should say saleswomen. They're all women. 90%, I think I was told, of sales staff are women. And that was very interesting because it's fine, architects design houses for rich people, so that's one process. But when you kind of get to the end of the line and you're sitting in a model home and you're essentially waiting for people to come and buy a house and they have all sorts of ideas, it's the other end of the process. It's It's the end that I think as architects we often really don't know very much about, but it's interesting. Housing is a strange business. The builders always call their homes products. They don't call them houses. And I think it's because they're trying to convince themselves that they're in a real kind of business, consumer business. But actually they're not. They're in a very odd business where they sell these houses one at a time, very slowly. Jason just told me that at New Daleville since January they're selling two houses a month. And they're really happy. In this market, that's a good record. Two houses a month. I mean, imagine if you sold any other product at two a month, I mean, other than books, is nothing. And yet, you know, the effort that goes into selling a house, which is, you know, a lot of money for those people that are buying it, and they're concerned, and they have other options. So that whole process comes down to this really ancient sort of antique ritual of selling the house and then building it based on what those people wanted. So it is definitely an odd business. One of the things I learned from listening to people talking of homebuyers, prospective homebuyers talking, was that they're really not driven by ideology at all. None of them had heard of new urbanism, I'm afraid. They were, on the other hand, aware that what they were looking at wasn't conventional, that there was a sense of, for instance, neighborhood and being close to people, and that appealed to people. I mean, clearly you don't move to a neighborhood where houses are close together unless you want to meet your neighbor. If you are a hermit, or if you're antisocial, or if you already have enough friends, and that covers a lot of population, you probably are not interested in living in a traditional neighborhood development. That's tough news if you're trying to sell them, but I believe that's true. On the other hand, the reverse is also true. The people who want to meet their neighbors, who enjoy a community life, and see that closeness will bring that together. And you can see there's only 25, 30 families living in New Daleville at the moment. And yet you can actually see that. They all know each other, and they tell you, we like it because we can walk down and we know our neighbors and they're close together and they take care of our kids and we take their kids, you know, to school or wherever it is. But ideology is not what they're buying. So one has to find ways to translate ideology into what it is that people actually want. I want to at least, I noticed that you have a session at the end that was mentioned as sort of back and forth, like crossfire or something, where people argue about things. So I wanted to add a couple of things you could argue about. One was the obsession with alleyways. And I understand all the reasons for it, but I noticed in New Daleville that the first half dozen houses sold were all houses with driveways. You know, there were edge conditions in the plan where it didn't make sense to put an alley in. Most of the community has alleys, but on the edge they didn't. People had driveways. And, you know, everybody chose one of those. It's true that they have a view out to over the field, so there may be other reasons they chose them. But it seemed to me that, for instance, Americans have two-car garages, but we have lots of stuff to put in them, not cars. We have boats and workshops and other things, objects that we own. And so the driveway is really where people park. And so if you have a two-car garage right on a lane, on an alleyway, nobody actually parks in their garage. That was my observation. And I'm from Canada, which has a really tough climate. And I lived in a rural area. Nobody ever parked in their garage. They always parked outside. And I presume it's either simplicity of not opening and closing the door, or simply that there's other things in the garage that are taking up space. So if you look at Raymond Unwin, who's one of the great inspirations, I think, for new urbanism, and if you look at his book, he does have a lot of... He doesn't have sort of the dumb lollipop cul-de-sacs, but he has all sorts of enclosed sort of closes, sort of loops, various ways in which you can create the sense of a cul-de-sac that people like. People, I should have mentioned that the other popular place that lots that sold, there was one loop that the planner had put in simply because he had an awkward shape on the land. And people loved that because first of all, they told me they really liked cul-de-sacs, but there weren't any because this was a new urbanism development. So they chose the loop because they said that way people don't have the traffic in front of the house. And I think that's a legitimate concern, and most of the people in this community have small children. They're either families with small children or families whose children are much older and have moved away. So I would question that both the alleys, whether there aren't some alternative solutions, or whether if there are alleys, is there some way of sort of dealing with providing the equivalent of a driveway, or perhaps simply mixing up the two and having at least enough lots so that the people who like all the elements that you're offering but have three cars, you know, have the place to park. TND is, I think, a big idea in real estate. I think Robert Davis and Liz and Andres at Seaside, I mentioned in the book, it's like discovering a new planet. I mean, the idea that you can build on small lots and sell them to Americans, you know, before Seaside, that was really impossible. That was not an idea that anybody could agree with. And yet Seaside showed that you could do that. So it's a very big idea. In the book, I have a conversation with Jason, and he tells me that I asked him what was different about real estate development from his previous job, which was working for a dot-com before the bust in San Francisco, a venture capital firm. And he said that in some businesses you could have a big idea and it could sort of take you along to the end, and that in development was many little ideas. And I think that's very important, particularly in this audience, because you do have this big idea, but it's easy to forget that development isn't really about big ideas, it's about little ideas. It's about every one of those little things being right, or the project fails. I can give an illustration of that, not from housing, but from hotels. I was talking once with the developer and owner of the Rittenhouse Hotel, which is just on the other side, and I don't think any of you stay there. It's a very expensive, beautiful hotel. And he said, you know, a hotel has to be perfect, because if you walk into a hotel room, say you've just checked in, and you walk into the bathroom and there's a towel on the floor, you feel awful. And, you know, if in your own bathroom you have a towel on the floor all the time, you don't even think about it. But in a hotel, you want perfection. Fortunately, residential development isn't quite that demanding. But you know, if the door creaks, or if the window doesn't open properly, you feel you've been had in your new house. You feel really bad about your new house, and you complain about it. So it's many little things, getting all these little things right in the permitting process, in the construction process, is really crucial in what makes development so difficult, and which still persists whether or not the development has this big overarching idea. TNDs have become formulaic, which is a good thing. It means you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do it. You know, the gray eminences of this movement, I believe, are rocket scientists. They're really smart people. But, you know, there aren't enough of people like that around. So you have to make a formula that people can, that are not so smart, can implement. And there are two projects I've seen recently that show this. One is Stapleton and one is Atlantic Station in Atlanta. Both new urban projects, I think Stapleton is sort of implemented in a much more sophisticated way. I think there are many kind of dumb things going on in Atlantic Station that are not great, but they're both, I think, good examples of how an idea percolates down and inevitably gets simplified and distorted and hopefully not completely turned upside down, but perhaps. And it gave me an idea for closing. Because I once invited Miles Tannenbaum, who's probably not on your list of places to visit in Philadelphia. He's the developer of King of Prussia. And he started the whole project from scratch. And he's no longer involved with it, but it's one of the most successful shopping malls, certainly in Pennsylvania and probably in the country. And he gave a talk to my students about his experiences, and he closed by saying about the real estate business, and these were mostly students who were either MBAs or real estate majors, or in some cases planners, but they were obviously interested in development, which was why they were in the class. And he said, this is a great business, because if you find something that works, you can just do it over and over again. And he built shopping malls over and over again all over this country. And then he said, but you can't take long vacations, because somebody's always coming up with a better idea. And I hope that the New Urbanism Congress doesn't take any long vacations, because somewheres out there, there's six more smart people trying to figure out, you know, what's the next thing after New Urbanism? What is it that people like about New Urbanism that we could do even better? So the thing about real estate development that I learned from this book, especially looking at the historical spread, was, you know, how changeable it is, partly because it's market-driven and people's ideas change. You know, nobody's building picture windows anymore. Nobody's building carports. Why? I mean, Americans just decided they didn't like them, is what I assume. I mean, a carport's a perfectly good idea. And yet, you know, we've stopped doing that. Now you have to have shutters, and you have to have gables and dormers. And think of the 50s when the house had none of those things. So it's a changeable, people change. Americans are very fickle. They like one thing one day, but something else the next. And if you're trying to satisfy them, as inevitably you are if you're in this business, that's something that you sort of have to be very aware of. And just as you all bring change to communities, change for the better, you also have to be prepared for change to work its way on you. Thank you.
Dziękuję. Dziękuję bardzo. We convene tomorrow at the hotel at 8 in the morning for the talk show among developers. Thank you for coming tonight. Enjoy Philadelphia. See you at 8 o'clock sharp tomorrow morning.